Hello and welcome to the Aster Economic Week in Review. My name is John Eckstein. I am Chief Investment Officer of Aster Investment Management. This week, we've got special guest Elizabeth Panicotti, who is a policy advisor at Employ America. Elizabeth, hello.
Hi, thanks so much for having me.
Thanks for coming. Elizabeth, what's your specialty at Employ America?
So I focus mainly on automatic stabilizers and implementing triggers into fiscal policy. And so right now my big focus is unemployment insurance, but at large, we as an organization sort of focus on triggers and Fed nominations promoting full and Fed policies promoting full employment.
And so can you just explain what an automatic stabilizer is in case some of our people don't have public policy degrees?
Yeah, no, sure. So rather than sort of, I guess a good example is when sort of unemployment insurance or other policies are put in place and they have kind of arbitrary end dates, such as ending on, you know, December 31st, you would instead say that they would stay in place or they would kick into place when the unemployment rate or some other kind of measure of economic success or, you know, downturn, they would stay in place until or when that sort of kicks up. And so, for example, you could have an unemployment insurance top off kick up when the unemployment rate hits 5 or 6%. Whereas currently most unemployment insurance benefits just sort of turn on and turn off when Congress decides they do. We sort of support the other kind of policy, which would kick on or kick off automatically based on labor market indicators.
Yeah, I mean, I sort of certainly support that too, but I guess I've sort of been led to believe that Congress doesn't want to, that's a better policy, but Congress would rather keep the power to themselves. Like, do you think that's true? Or do you think, is there movement in the direction of some more automatic stabilizers?
I think it's both. I think like Congress has certainly retained that power and has also been concerned about the cost of these programs. We think about reforming welfare programs when we need them the most. And that is when the CBO scores them the highest. And so I think there's a bit of a concern about cost, especially now as we sort of talk about, you know, what's the appropriate amount to spend on COVID relief. And I think too, for Congress, the power to be able to turn on and off these programs at their whim and at their, you know, when it's most politically convenient is obviously something some people are opposed to giving away, though in the House we had over 100 members sign on to supporting automatic stabilizers in COVID relief. And so I think there is sort of changing of the tides. And this is certainly a moment where, given, you know, Congress's makeup or the president, et cetera, it would be helpful to have them.
Yeah, I think the public's probably have a new salience for jobless benefits. And so was that a bipartisan or was that mainly one side that was supporting the more stabilizers?
I don't think it was bipartisan. I think it's primarily been a liberal policy, though. I think, you know, in talking with offices on the Hill, we have, I think, garnered a lot more support for these programs and for them being tied to labor market conditions than there have been in prior years. You know, the main program, especially in the UI space, that is currently an automatic stabilizer or tied to a trigger is the extended benefits program, which we, you know, we get information on in the weekly claims report. And that is tied to the unemployment rate and the insured unemployment rate. The latter is not so great of a trigger, but you know, these programs do exist, like they were at one point passed in Congress. And so it's not an insurmountable battle to get these things into place. And I think we'll start to see them come up over the next few years. And, you know, the economists that President-elect Biden has put into his cabinet and surrounded himself with have been proponents of stabilizers. So I think we might see movement on that in the upcoming administration.
So let's talk about, we're recording this on Thursday the 14th, a couple of hours after the claims number, the weekly claims number came out. So this week, the seasonally adjusted number was almost 1 million new claims for unemployment, up from about 800,000 last week. And so what do you make of that number?
Yeah, so on the seasonally adjusted basis, the nice thing is that during the COVID pandemic, I think there's been a tendency to not focus on the seasonally adjusted number, given that the current seasons are not so correlated with previous seasons. Though, however, this week, the last 2 weeks of data, we always see a dent. Like in the last 20 years, I think almost every year we see quite a significant dip in claims, especially those state claims in the weeks containing the Christmas holiday and the New Year's holiday, because state offices are closed, business offices are closed, et cetera. And so sort of an uptick in this week, the week ending January 9th, is not so out of character. And what's nice is the seasonal adjustment actually should correct for some of that claim activity, you know, the downturn in claim activity. That said, when we look at the initial claims on a non-seasonally adjusted basis, which is kind of what we've been doing for the last, you know, 9-10 months, when we look at that number, it has not been above 1 million since the end of July. And so it, you know, in some sense, it is quite disheartening to think about the labor market being so weak that we are reverting back to the middle of the year. I will say that I would expect that because the last 2 weeks we had such a downturn, this week is sort of the uptick is not immediately alarming to me, because I think over the last 2 weeks, people probably delayed filing those applications either due to holiday closures or due to the uncertainty surrounding the COVID relief package that was passed at the very last minute. And then, you know, the delayed signing by President Trump. And so that uptick, I think, is concerning. It's not great. It obviously doesn't show a very strong labor market. That said, I think if we haven't settled out to where we're seeing kind of downturn in those claims by the end of the month, I think we should be more alarmed than I am now. But I think right now, you know, these blips are a little bit artificial and we should expect them to settle down over the next couple of weeks, especially when it comes to the federal extension programs, because those were, you know, President Trump delayed signing that COVID relief bill. And so those programs lapsed overnight. And many states had pre-programmed those programs to sort of cut off and either move people onto other benefits or to close out their claims entirely or to kind of pause their claims. And so we'll see a couple of weeks where states are kind of scrambling to implement the extensions of the programs and get everyone's claims squared away. And as a result, we'll see a bit of movement in all of the federal extension programs and maybe even the state claims numbers as states sort of work through that process of going through the guidance from the Department of Labor and working through the bill, et cetera. And so I think it's sort of like back in March when we were seeing these massive numbers and, you know, we knew they would be short term and we knew some of them were just a function of like, you know, massive layoffs or delays in getting people on board or Congress implementing new bills. It's sort of a bit of a reminder of how that process felt, though with thankfully not 6 million claims per week.
Right, so I guess so you're hoping that we're going to be back below 800,000 by February?
I think that's the hope, though. I think it's very possible that if we dig into these numbers a bit, if we look at the continuing claims for state versus the federal programs, we right. should so do those.
Yeah. So let's just review those numbers real quick. So on January 2nd, which is the last week that we have the data for continuing claims, we've got about 6 million people on the state program. And then in the pandemic unemployment insurance, we've got about another 7.5 million people.
Yeah. So if we focus on that
pandemic emergency, you see, we've got 4 million people. Extended benefits, we've got 1 million people. So that's 18 million. That's 18.5 million ish altogether.
Yeah. It's a big number. If we look at, so we'll go down the list, I think, in that order. If we look at the state claims, we're up by 500,000 between the weeks of December 26th and January 2nd. That is a scary number in my mind, because those typically are new layoffs. So when you get laid off, you go apply for state benefits and you have to exhaust your state benefits before you move on to those federal extension programs. Granted, for PUA as well, you do have to apply to the state system and then get denied, and then you move over to the PUA system. So some of those claims will be, you know, from the claims data, they'll be PUA claims. From the continuing claims data, those won't be PUA claims. And so that kind of 475,000 increase in continuing state claims is really alarming. And I think that's in line with job losses that we saw in the December jobs report. And it's a bit of a preview for what we'll see in, I think, the January jobs report of probably a greater downturn or at least a flat line between January and December.
I would agree with that. And so now I guess we're seeing people shifting off of the pandemic unemployment insurance or continuation and onto extended benefits. Is that true also?
Yeah. So people on PUA won't move to extended benefits. They're not eligible. Only people that were originally on state extended benefits that are kind of these traditional unemployed workers are eligible for the EB program. However, folks who are on the PEUC, the Pandemic Emergency Unemployment Compensation Program, those people can move over to EB if their state is triggered on. So what likely happened the night of the 26th is, so everyone was eligible for benefits the week of the 26th. You stayed on them through that week. Then the morning of the 27th, so when midnight struck on the 27th, the week that begins on the 27th, they would have, computer programs in a lot of states were programmed to move those people over to EB because PEUC had ended. I think next week we'll get a preview of like what that shift looked like. But for now, we only have continuing claims data for the federal programs through December 26th. It's lagged by one more week. So we don't yet see that. Though we do see 1 million people coming off of PUA that week and 325,000 people coming off PEUC that week. And so I think that speaks more to, you know, Congress extended the number of weeks people are eligible for both of those programs. And that really speaks to how necessary that extension was, because a lot of people were exhausting the 39 weeks of PUA and the 13 weeks of PEUC. Both of those programs were extended by 11 weeks.
So just to remind listeners, so the PUA is for gig workers and self-employed workers who are not traditionally not covered under state unemployment insurance. Do you think that this is going to lead to a rethink in that, and that gig workers will be able to participate in unemployment insurance, or no?
I think Congress is really going to have a reckoning with that. You know, I think over the next kind of 8 to 10 months, there will be a lot of calls for, you know, after we get kind of the next stimulus package and we do more short-term relief, I think conversations will likely shift to long-term reforms. And those will be concentrated on a whole host of programs. You know, I think there were a lot of programs that were inadequate for this crisis. And you know, if we look back at the Great Recession, they were probably inadequate then too, or they've faced cuts since then. But I think UI is like a particular, UI is kind of facing a particular reckoning with how inadequate the system is, either administratively, in terms of eligibility, in terms of generosity, you know, in terms of program integrity and fraud. There's kind of this whole, you know, it's kind of this like big mushroom effect where there was just this massive influx of claims, and not that states should have been able to deal with that, but, you know, we're 10 months into this and they still can't deal with it. And, you know, with 700,000 people on pandemic unemployment assistance showing that they're ineligible for traditional state programs, I think Congress is really going to have to revisit what the eligibility criteria are for those programs and likely bring in self-employed and independent contractors, workers, and workers with, you know, non-traditional arrangements where they're part-time, or even in some states, low-wage workers aren't eligible for UI. And so I hope that over the next several months, you know, we'll kind of look at a big federal reform to UI and bring in those workers. I think it would be hard too for Congress to say, okay, well, we have this temporary program and now we don't need it anymore, so none of you are eligible. Like, I don't think that's a particularly politically salient idea, given that so many workers were able to be kind of picked up by that program.
Yeah. And a lot of sort of like petty bourgeoisie, for lack of a better term, like, you know, the self-employed people, you know, photographers or journalists who are setting this up, like a lot of small business owners who don't employ other people, who are a politically salient group. So just in the numbers, something that sort of puzzled me, like, we still see a million people. So let's say it goes back to 700,000, 800,000 people filing new claims for unemployment insurance. So, but that doesn't match up to the number of people moving from employed to unemployed in the payroll report, does it?
That's true. Yeah. So I think this crisis has really highlighted how the unemployment rate doesn't necessarily reflect the employment level of the entire labor market. And so I think, especially last month, but really all the months of this crisis, it's been really important to also look at, you know, the labor force participation rate, looking at, you know, where job gains or job losses are concentrated, either, you know, between gender groups or race groups or sector groups or education groups. You know, really looking at disaggregated data has been important, but also focusing on, you know, alternative measures of unemployment, like the more generous U6. So, you know, we typically look at the top line number, which is U3. That's just the kind of normal unemployment rate. Then there are a number of alternative measures that kind of include other workers, such as workers who are either part-time for economic reasons, or maybe they were too discouraged to look for work, et cetera, so they dropped out of the labor force. I think looking at the labor force participation rate, you know, maybe it doesn't fully line up with the UI claim data. And I think we've seen that throughout the crisis and in other recessions where like Thursday claims data has almost never been perfectly or even imperfectly correlated with the jobs report. So this is not abnormal. And, you know, there's a bunch of economists who will posit on why that is. And, you know, some of that is access to UI, downplaying job losses. Some of that is, you know, expanded programs are just so different and non-comparable. But I think that the tables I've really focused on in the jobs report are those COVID supplemental, the pandemic supplemental tables that have, if you were out of work or if you lost work or reduced your hours due to business closures or loss of business because of the pandemic. And there were a ton of workers categorized in that group in the last employment report. So if we look at the entire labor force, nearly 13 million workers, or 8% of the labor force, were unable to work because their employer closed or lost business due to the coronavirus pandemic in December. And, you know, if we dive in deeper to that, only 14% of those people received any sort of compensation. So not their full wages, but just any compensation. Additionally, if we look at those not in the labor force, 3% of people not in the labor force were in the same situation, and 9% of those received pay. So it, you know, it's sort of hard to think about if you're not in the labor force, how are you unable to work because your employer closed and you receive, you know, some of those people receive pay. Like, it's sort of complicated. And if we think about the, you know, the BLS survey takers, it's sort of hard to tease out the specific employment you know, the very complicated employment situations of these folks. And as a result, I think those top line numbers we typically rely on, where most people have pretty straightforward employment or unemployment answers, that's not really the case in this crisis. And that's due to, you know, increases in business closure orders around the country as, you know, virus cases uptick, business closures due to, you know, maybe PPP loans running out or short time compensation agreements running out or access to credit or whatever. You know, there's all of these kind of very specific business reasons that affect workers. And as a result, we see them sort of differently in the survey that goes into the jobs report than we would normally see them. And BLS has done a really fantastic job of trying to correct. That said, you know, if you think about those survey takers on the phone, it's quite complicated to think about someone telling you, I'm not in the labor force, but I was unable to work because my employer closed, but I received pay from that person, and trying to square that up with, well, would that person be eligible for, you know, unemployment insurance? I don't really know. So I think that's really the source of the discrepancy between the two reports. And I think it will be years before we really understand, you know, the sources of those discrepancies and how prevalent they were and, you know, the specific kind of descriptions of those.
Okay, so but you basically think that there are 750,000 people getting laid off every week. And so, you know, 3 million people a month are really losing their jobs. You think that's actual accurate number?
I think that for the state claims, that's probably more accurate. We've seen a lot of fraud in the PUA space. And, you know, that is a more complicated space where there could be fraudulent claims, but there also is just like massive under and over reporting because state systems still don't really know how to handle the influx of claims. So I think it's both. I'd say one more thing is that we know a lot of people. I think there was a paper by the California Policy Lab that they have administrative access. They have access to administrative data from the California UI office, so they see individual claims data.
And yeah, I think they have some amazing data.
Yeah, they have really great data. So I think they said something like 60% of workers have come in and out of UI at least once. And so it's not it's not so much that unique workers are losing their jobs every month. It's that people come on UI, then they go back to work for a month and they go back on UI. You know, it's like this flow on and off of UI. Mm-hmm. And so that I think makes the numbers between the two reports make a bit more sense as well. The other thing is that 40% of unemployed workers have been unemployed for over 26 weeks or 6 months. And so a lot of these people are not flowing in and out of UI and are not flowing in and out of unemployment. And that I think is the really detrimental, you know, that's where we start to see those detrimental long-term effects of unemployment.
Yeah, I mean, that's when like the longer separated from the labor market, the harder it is for you to get back in. And yeah, that gets very dangerous.
Yeah.
From a societal standpoint.
From a macroeconomic standpoint, yeah.
And so do you know, have other states been looking into the fraud? So the fraud was mainly in the PUA. Have the other states been looking into that too?
Or I think, I mean, all states. So in the new bill, there was a lot of focus on, in the bill passed in December, in the new stimulus bill, there was a lot of focus on how to make kind of all the federal extensions have more program integrity. And so there will be, you know, now there are increased requirements for documentation for PUA workers. Some of those, I think, you know, critics have said that those will be very burdensome on workers. And, you know, in states like Florida, for example, where they have historically tried to, you know, block access to UI, there's concern that that would be, you know, detrimental to low-wage workers and to workers of color and just generally a burden on workers. And so I think it will be a very careful balance between making sure that people who are applying getting benefits are the people who are supposed to be applying getting benefits, and also making sure that, you know, workers who have faced, you know, really a lot of hardships in the last, you know, 10 months are not so burdensome by these new requirements. The other thing is that California, they do a lot of prepaid debit cards for their unemployment benefits, and they work with Bank of America. And, you know, there was kind of a report this week where there's a lot of news reports in the last couple of weeks where they've been freezing those accounts to where workers can't use those benefits. And that was a fraud prevention measure to say like, hey, you're not supposed to be on these benefits. We're cutting you off so that you can't, you know, swipe your debit card. The problem with doing that, though, is that not all of those claims were fraudulent. And as a result, you know, there are a lot of workers who have been in the news lately saying, I'm a real unemployed worker. I am supposed to be eligible for these benefits. And they cut me off with no notification they didn't even provide me a chance to say it wasn't a fraudulent claim. And so I think states will really have to work hard over the next few months to, you know, tackle fraud in a humane and effective way rather than just kind of blanket, we're cutting benefits off or issuing overpayment notices, et cetera.
Right. Well, that'll be interesting to track. You know, one more thing I wanted to get your take on is, you know, we look at the JOLTS numbers. So that's the job openings and turnover survey sort of historically. So like right now, it says there's, you know, 6.5 million jobs open. That number's always like super high, right? Like, and like, it doesn't feel like there's 6.5 million jobs open right now, right? Like, so if you do something more formal, you look at the jobs openings compared to the unemployment rate, the so-called Beveridge curve, the current number is, you know, is much higher. The relation, the number of job openings per unemployed person is extremely high right now. What do you think is going on there? Like the jobs openings aren't real job openings or just, because if they really wanted to fill the jobs, they just raised their wage, right?
Yeah, I mean, that's kind of the theory behind why tight labor markets are so good. I think it's two things. I think one, that unemployment rate that's used for the Beveridge curve, as we just talked about, is kind of deflated in a way such that it doesn't capture all of the people out of work who would, you know, be willing to fill or be open to filling those job openings.
That would actually make it worse though, right? The unemployment
that would make it worse.
That would make it even worse.
That would mean there are more unemployed workers for
I'm saying there's more unemployed workers than normal. There's more job openings per unemployed worker than you'd expect today. And you're saying that the number is even higher than what just like taking the numbers at face value is.
It'd be the opposite. So there would be fewer job openings per unemployed worker if there were
fewer
more
job
unemployed workers.
Okay, so why do you think there's fewer job openings?
Just if the denominator of unemployed workers gets larger, then there's just fewer, like the ratio of job openings per unemployed worker goes down if there are more unemployed workers. But I think too, the job opening number also accounts for these people who are like, their job is open in the short term when they're refilling those positions. So like, let's say for example, restaurants, if a restaurant was required to close or to do takeout only, and then that closure order was lifted, you know, you might see that influx of job openings, but really they're rehiring their previous workers or whatnot. I don't have a, you know, I do agree. Like it doesn't really seem like there are 6.5 million jobs, though openings are below, are about 7% below pre-pandemic levels when we had a really tight labor market. So I will say that like, you know, this is not, this kind of level of job opening is not inconceivable though for the current labor market. I think you're right in that it's probably too high. I don't have a ton to say, and I know Nick Bunker at Indeed is a big JOLTS guy, and he'd be a good person to have on your show.
Yeah, I should actually ask Nick about this because
Nick is really
I don't understand why businesses really would want to hire. I mean, it was significant, you know, it's like, you know, like I say, it was usually 7 million, now it's 6.5 million. And the numbers the same. Like if you could hire somebody profitably, like why don't you just keep raising your wages $1 a month until you fill those and make that profit? So I think there's, I don't know, but I don't know exactly what that is.
I mean, I think from a fully, you know, a tighter labor market perspective, that would obviously, you know, if there are too many job openings per worker, then you would raise your wages to make yourself more competitive, and we'd have tighter labor markets. We know that's good for everyone. If we look at kind of the JOLTS graphs that they kind of include, or Nick always makes some really good ones on JOLTS Day, we know that separations are kind of ticking up and that hires are really flatlining. And so, you know, maybe the I think there will be people quick to jump on the kind of mismatch or the skills gap, but hopefully they stay away from that conversation.
Yeah, there's a quote from Baynard actually that came out that said that the Federal Reserve staff indicates that unemployment is likely above 20% for workers in the bottom wage quartile and falling below 5% for the top wage quartile.
Yeah, I mean, I think this coronavirus pandemic has really highlighted, and you know, subsequent economic downturn, I think it's really highlighted disparities in our labor market and how hard low wage workers and service workers and workers of color have been hit by this. You know, it's been certainly disproportionate to their kind of, I think I saw some statistic that like college educated workers have pretty much, their labor market conditions have completely rebounded and they're totally fine. And I think it's really a story of like who's able to work from home and which businesses have been insulated from downturn or made money in this crisis. And so I think it's really a story of that, but it is certainly unfortunate.
You're the kids too. That's why it's a gender gap.
Yeah, I think the childcare story is quite disheartening and will certainly require a lot of work from Congress in the coming year.
Was there anything else you feel like talk about or?
No, I think the main takeaway is that, you know, the last couple of weeks of data. Oh, I will say too that the JOLTS data is from November 2020, so it's lagged by one more month. But I think the real takeaway of this is that as we usher in a new administration with very different economic principles, I think they will really have to think critically about what sort of fiscal stimulus is needed. The Fed over the next year will have to think about what sort of monetary policy is needed. But really, in the short term, the strength of the labor market is not great. And I think the January jobs report will look probably worse than the December jobs report.
I agree with that as the virus continues. And just so to recap sort of where we are in a nutshell, you know, we lost, say, 22 million jobs at the worst of the crisis. We've made about 12 million back, but the pace of recovery was attenuating before up through November, and in December, lost more jobs again. And I feel like the next 2 months, job losses are baked in the cake as well. I might be a little bit over pessimistic on February, but.
I think it will really depend on, you know, vaccine distribution, which hasn't been, you know, has been lackluster so far. But even if we could vaccinate everybody, it does take time for these things to happen.
Yeah. Just two more things I want to mention quickly. One is CPI came out and inflation is still well below the Fed's target of 2%. The core rate is about 1.5%. We do expect inflation to bounce based on the weakness of the dollar and, you know, compositional, you know, year-over-year comparisons, comparing to weak previous years will be coming up. Plus, eventually people are going to go out and spend a lot of money. So inflation will bounce short-term, but we'll see if it can stay sustainably above or near 2%. We've been starting to get much more negative sentiment numbers. Sentiment had improved steadily from, say, March or April, consumer sentiment, or from April or May. And now they've really taken a dive. And part of that is due to Republicans being sad that the Democrats are coming in office. Like, this happened in the reverse in 2016, where Democrats became much more pessimistic about the economy. Republicans became much more optimistic in November. Now the opposite is happening, but the thing is that the small business owners are like skew Republican too. So that makes the sentiment numbers from small businesses look negative too. So some sort of compilations of consumer sentiment, including the ones that we look at here at Aster, are heading south. And that is all the news we're going to cover this week. So we encourage you to go to the Aster website if you'd like charts, more data analysis. That's Aster IM. That's AsterInvestmentManagement.com. We'll be back next week with my colleague, Nick Porter. Elizabeth, thank you so much for taking the time and sharing your knowledge on the labor market with us.
Yep. Thanks so much for having me.
Thanks. Have a good week. Bye.
You too. Bye-bye.
To learn more about Aster Investment Management's research and strategies, please visit us on the web at www.asterim.com or stay up to date by following us on LinkedIn, Twitter, and our app is also available on the App Store and Google Play. Thank you. Aster Investment Management, LLC, is a SEC-registered investment advisor. All information contained herein is for informational purposes only. This is not a solicitation to offer investment advice or services in any state where to do so would be unlawful. Analysis and research are provided for informational purposes only, not for trading or investing purposes. All opinions expressed are as of the date of publication and subject to change. They are not intended as investment recommendations.